Al Jazeera Podcasts.
Today, Al Jazeera investigates the events of October 7th.
Hamas and others committed very real crimes on October the 7th. The oddity was that in the days that followed, the world's media focused not on the crimes they did commit, but on crimes they did not commit.
I'm Kevin Hurton, and this is The Take.
My name is Richard Sanders. I was producer director on Al Jazeera's investigative unit's new film, October 7th, which is a film about the events of October the 7th in Israel.
So, Richard, we work together in Al Jazeera's investigative unit. Why don't we start with the essence of the documentary, and then we can drill down on some of the finer points. So what is this story about?
Okay, so it's essentially a very forensic, detailed analysis of exactly what happens on October the 7th, and an analysis, really, of the way the story has been told subsequently. What we conclude is that Hamas and others who came through the fence that day were certainly guilty of human rights abuses. There is no doubt about that. But that many of the most lurid stories, the sort of stories that were repeated again and again and were used in particular to justify the Israeli assault on the Gaza Strip, many of those stories were not true.
The film creates a timeline of the day of October 7th, beginning at dawn as Hamas fighters break through the fence and enter Israel. And a lot of that timeline is public knowledge at this point, but the film gives us a beat-by-beat picture of just how it unfolded. And it does this by using actual footage of the day, from CCTVs to dash cam footage to actual body cam footage from the Hamas fighters themselves. From the timeline, we see how for the entire morning of October 7th, Israel puts up almost no resistance. And I'm tempted to ask how Israel didn't see this coming, but from speaking to a former Israeli official, and as you show in the film, they did see this coming, right?
Yes, it's hubris, really. Hamas were hardly keeping it secret. You know, you can see them training in the open. In many cases, only a few hundred yards from the fence. I mean, almost everywhere in Gaza is only a few hundred yards from the fence in a way. Mm. And they were actually filming these training sessions and putting them online. The Israelis simply misread them. Their reading was that Hamas was contained. Mm. Hamas was preoccupied with running the Gaza Strip, that Hamas did not have the ambition or the capacity to actually do this. And they clearly completely underestimated them.
In the film, Chuck Freilich, a former Israeli deputy national security advisor, explains the response after word first got to the country's military intelligence and the internal security service, the Shin Bet.
In the early hours of the morning, there's already pretty good information that something is happening, to the point that the head of the Shin Bet and I think shortly after the chief of staff all arrive in their offices, 2-3 in the morning. And it is, again, it's written off probably as being just another exercise. And the decision is to come back in the morning and take a look at it again. Of course, between those hours and then the attack at 6:30 a.m., it was too late.
At 6 a.m., the Hamas fighters are told to gather together at meeting points.
No one of the fighters have an idea about this operation, up to minutes before the operation.
This is Bassem Naim, a member of the Hamas Political Bureau.
It was so close, and very few members of the mainly of the military leadership and maybe one or two from the political bureau who were aware about the operation.
At dawn, Hamas fighters come into Israel by land, air, and sea. They begin their attack. Fighters break through the fence.
We've identified at least 10 points where they storm through, and they attack the large number of military bases that there are surrounding the Gaza Strip, and they completely overrun. And this is where they pay the price for this complacency, really. Many of the soldiers are caught in bed. You can see it in the videos. They haven't even had time to get armed and get their uniforms on. They're taken completely by surprise. And so what that means is that Hamas takes itself by surprise. And this is, comes through very clearly, talking to Bassem Naim from the Hamas General Council.
Anyone who have watched this were surprised. I was totally surprised. How can this happen?
They were completely taken aback by the ease with which they went through the frontier.
But the fighters continue. From military bases to kibbutzim, residential settlements close to the fence, to a music festival with thousands of young people just 5 kilometers from Gaza.
Based on my information, they were not aware that there is a musical festival in the area.
The film homes in on a few specific moments captured from Hamas body cams. One of them comes from bomb shelters along the highway, next to where the music festival was taking place.
So when Hamas turned up, they had, you know, between these bomb shelters, about 100 people. It's quite clear the principal aim that day was to take hostages. What they do is they stand outside for some time, throwing hand grenades in and firing their machine guns, and then eventually sort of haul out dying or injured people and load them into trucks and take them off as hostages.
Yeah.
So, yeah, and that it's very disturbing to watch. You can hear the screams of the people in the bomb shelters. The other thing that has happened by this point is that from pretty early in the morning, word goes round that these breaches have been made and that the Israeli army has just disappeared. Hamas is followed through the fence by gunmen from a number of other organizations, Islamic Jihad and so on, but then also by waves and waves of civilians.
Yeah, it was like a jailbreak. So things begin to change around the middle of the day. By then, the Israeli army is mobilized. The Israeli army would eventually release footage of some of its helicopter strikes. And pilots would go on to say that it was hard to tell the difference between Hamas fighters and civilians. Can you talk about that part of the documentary?
Yes. So the reporting in Israel is that at midday, the army issues a version of what is called the Hannibal Directive. The Hannibal Directive is something that first emerged in the 1980s. It was a protocol whereby the Israeli military decided it was better that soldiers be killed rather than allowing them to be captured. This is because in the past you've had these extraordinary prisoner exchanges of 1,000 Palestinians for one Israeli soldier. The reporting in the Israeli press, specifically the newspaper Yediot Aronot, is that Apache helicopter pilots in particular are told you can take the risk of hitting hostages.
There is a story of a kibbutz resident who came under fire from an Israeli helicopter.
That's right. So the Israeli military has not denied this story. Israel's Channel 12 interviewed a woman who was abducted on the morning of the 7th. She's with 9 people. There, 9 of them are sort of loaded onto a flatback, and they come under fire from a helicopter.
And as we are advancing about 0.5 kilometer from the fence, the helicopter fires gunshots, shooting at us. And I'm sure that this is it. I will die now. I am done for. And then I raise my head and I am alive.
Now, one of the hostages is definitely killed, and the interviewee herself is quite badly injured. In fact, she later plays dead, which is why she doesn't end up as a hostage. So there is that direct account. I suspect it happened quite a few times, and we don't know about it because the people that happened to are dead. Mm. We've done a very careful analysis, and we reckon, in addition to that one person we know died, there are 27 people who are taken hostage, who never make it to the fence, and who die in circumstances that are unclear.
Okay, so Israel said it regained control of the south on October 9th. And in the aftermath, officials did a number of press conferences in front of homes that came under attack. And you really don't need to be a forensic expert to notice that the damage looks like it came from tanks. They're like huge holes in the side of a house, which Hamas really didn't have access to that sort of weaponry on October 7th. So what did you learn through this evidence about how Israeli ground troops were operating?
You're right. You can look at the damage. Places like Kibbutz Be'eri and Kfar Aza have suffered enormous damage, and it's clearly not damage which is caused by sidearms and RPG fire. Now, Hamas, in order to smoke people out of their safe rooms, was setting houses on fire. So quite often you see a house which is burned out. Now that quite possibly was Hamas or other gunmen or other elements. But you also see a lot of houses which are clearly simply destroyed by heavy weaponry. And that's been done by the Israelis. One of the survivors that you hear from in the film is Yasmin Peratt, who was at the music festival, fled to Kibbutz Be'eri, and ended up in this house in total, I think, with 15 other hostages in all. Now, she escapes because one of the gunmen decides to surrender and takes her out as a human shield. She describes she's standing next to the soldiers and she sees them bring a tank up and they're preparing to fire.
And they suddenly brought a tank. And I asked one of the soldiers, but if you shoot shells, won't they harm the hostages? And he tells me, no, we're only doing it on the sides to take down walls.
But it's clear that that tank is what kills a substantial number of the hostages inside that house.
They weren't killed because they were executed. They were killed by the shooting.
It seems there were 12 hostages, including two children, who were killed inside that house.
After the break, how media coverage of the day shaped the war we're seeing now.
Welcome to Necessary Tomorrows. My name is Ursula. I am an AI. And I have inferred from your online activity that you have been feeling more dread than hope when you think about the future that is coming for us here in the 2060s. So I have created a course just for you to enhance your capacity for imagining different futures. Necessary Tomorrows, an audio series by Doha Debates and Al Jazeera. Find it where you listen to podcasts.
A quick reminder before we get back to our show. If you're listening to The Take on Google Podcasts, starting April 2nd, the app will no longer be available. So find us on YouTube Music, Spotify, CastBox, or any other podcast platform.
Okay, so in the days after October 7th, a lot of the media honed in on a few key stories, stories that really don't match up with your own death toll or Israel's, for that matter. You interviewed Yossi Landau from the volunteer organization Zaka, which was tasked with collecting the bodies from the kibbutzim. So I have three questions for you to help our listeners understand this. What is Zaka? Who is Yossi Landau? And why is it important to interview him for the film?
So Zaka is an organization of ultra-Orthodox volunteers who collect bodies and prepare them for Jewish burial in the wake of natural disasters and so on. Yossi Landau was the head of Zaka in the south of Israel. He's enormously important because a lot of the stories that emerge in the international media in the days after the 7th of October come from Zaka officials, and in particular from Yossi Landau. I mean, you know, respect to him for agreeing to be interviewed. Very few other people were prepared to be interviewed. We interviewed him because there were a number of stories that were clearly extremely problematic. And we confronted him with the problems with these stories, and viewers can judge for themselves whether he effectively deals with those problems. I mean, for example, he had said that there was one house in Be'eri where he'd come across two piles of 10 children in each of the piles, so 20 children who were all bound up, burned, and murdered.
Two piles of 10 children each were tied to the back, burned to death. It's indescribable, and I won't describe everything that I saw.
Now, for a start, the problem with that is there are only 10 children killed at Kibbutz Be'eri. Most of the children who die on the 7th of October die at Kibbutz Be'eri. But even so, there are only 10. There are not 20.
But still, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu repeated the claim in a conversation with U.S. President Joe Biden.
They took dozens of children, bound them up, burned them, and executed them.
Here's how he responded when Richard asked him for photos of what happened.
Not children, it's 18-year-old. So we're all together. When you look at them and they're burned, you don't know exactly the ages. So you're talking about 18-year-old, 20 years old, and you just don't look on the spot identification to see the ages or something like that.
On interviewing Yossi Landau, it became quite clear that the house he was referring to is the one we've already been talking about, where the hostages were actually killed by Israeli forces. So he makes no mention of that. And we know who was in that house. There were two children in that house, 12-year-old twins. And there simply weren't two piles of 10 children bound up together. Another story he tells, again, Kibbutz Be'eri, encountering a pregnant woman whose stomach has been cut open, the baby has been pulled out, still attached to the umbilical cord, stabbed, and the woman murdered.
She was a pregnant woman. Her stomach was butchered open. The baby that was connected to the cord was stabbed, and she was shot in the back.
That was Yossi Landau speaking to the media in October. Here's how he responded when Richard asked him for photos of what happened.
This is the baby. This is it.
I'm sorry to be graphic here, but I can't see a baby here.
You can't see the baby but this is the picture of the mother.
Okay.
For sure, you know, we didn't think when we were over there, we didn't think to camera everything.
Now, the kibbutz itself has said this simply isn't true. There is no such victim at Be'eri.
We contacted the Israeli government, military, and Zaka, but none responded to our findings.
Now, Zaka itself then put out a statement saying, well, look, our volunteers are not trained forensically. They're not qualified to give these judgments, which obviously begs the question why they were giving these judgments and why the Western media was simply accepting these judgments.
Al Jazeera's investigative unit also investigated another claim that made its way across Western media.
The Israelis claim there was widespread and systematic sexual assault and rape, that this was used as a weapon of war by Hamas. What we have found is that when you really pick it apart, the evidence for this comes almost entirely from Israeli officials and first responders, who we know from the issues around babies being killed are unreliable. Now, if you take them out of the equation, what are we left with? We have two witnesses, basically, that they come back to again and again. There may be many reasons in these traumatic situations why people don't talk, why it takes them a long time to talk, and all of that has to be taken into account. But it's odd that there's only two witnesses. Second point, there's no forensic evidence. There's no forensic evidence at all. Now, this can, again, be to do with the chaos of the aftermath, the difficulty of collecting forensic evidence, the need to bury people quickly in accordance with Jewish ritual, and so on. Possibly. But again, the fact is there is no forensic evidence. You then have thousands of post-mortem photographs. None indicates rape or sexual violence. Now, some of it, it's been suggested some of it does, but there's really not a great deal you can read from a corpse. And again, Zaka says we weren't documenting in that way. But the fact is there are thousands of photographs of the aftermath. And the fact that nothing shows this, I think, raises suspicions. Now, to be clear here, I'm not suggesting there were no rapes. But the idea that it was widespread and systematic, there is simply no evidence to support this.
And why is that an important distinction, widespread and systematic?
Well, I think the idea of widespread and systematic is that Hamas were deliberately using it as a weapon of war. Mm-hmm. Whereas I think if it did happen, it was isolated instances where discipline broke down. Also, why widespread and systematic would indicate that it was far, far, you know, wider, far more prevalent than was the case if it's a few isolated instances.
That's something lawyer Madeline Rees, the Secretary General for the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom, mentions in the film as well.
In every conflict, whenever there are men with guns intent on perpetrating violence, it is highly unlikely there will not be sexual violence. But nothing that I've seen put forward so far suggests that it was widespread and systematic. It's a very high bar to actually reach.
Earlier this year, a team of UN experts went to Israel to investigate and found, quote, reasonable grounds to believe that rape had occurred during the attack on October 7th.
If you actually read it, though, it's clear that conscientious professionals worked on it. Again, it is relying almost entirely on the testimonies of Israeli officials and first responders. It states very clearly there is no photographic or video evidence at all. It states very clearly that there are very few witnesses. So you actually look at the detail of that report, and for me anyway, it certainly doesn't contradict the sort of conclusions we were coming to.
What have you heard from the Israeli government about your findings?
Nothing at all. They don't want to talk to us.
One thing that some of the viewers might find surprising is that you interviewed someone from Hamas. Do you think that that will be controversial?
Well, it may be controversial, but it's absurd not to. As I say, we're absolutely frank and clear in the film about the crimes that Hamas committed on October the 7th. But if your view of Hamas and your analysis of Hamas begins and ends with they are monsters who do monstrous things because they are monsters, you're obviously not getting very far in understanding things. Hamas is ultimately a rational actor, and whatever you think of their actions, they do things for a reason. And if you're actually going to try and understand what happens on October the 7th, clearly you have to try and understand why Hamas was doing it. Hamas is defensive. Hamas, I think, is in denial about the scale of the killing of civilians that went on. But if you actually listen carefully to what they're saying, there is an acknowledgement that it didn't quite go as they'd planned. They will talk about the degree to which they were taken by surprise, by the collapse of the Israeli military. And I think they have a sense that there was an element of anarchy that then prevailed in which things occurred that certainly shouldn't have. They'll also point out to you the number of civilians who poured through the border. Mm. Now, you know, whether that's a justification or an excuse or not is another matter. I mean, one remarkable thing in the film, the Hamas man we talked to and others talk about the March of Return, the Great March of Return in 2018-19. Of course, that was not a protest that was straightforwardly organized by Hamas. But for those who are not familiar with it, essentially the peaceful demonstrations were organized along the fence. And the Israeli response was for snipers to line up along the sand berms and simply to shoot people. I mean, hundreds of people were killed. This was peaceful demonstration. I think that there was a single day in early 2018 where more than 60 people were killed. And it brought it home very clearly that peaceful protest simply wasn't going to work. It was simply going to be ignored. And Bassem Naim in the film, the Hamas leader, says,
during the Great March of Return, we went peacefully in thousands. But what was the response of the international community? Nothing. Keeping the ears and eyes always closed. Within this context, we have discussed in many times, in many sessions, what can we do? Generally, there was a consensus in the political bureau. We have to move. We have to take action. If we don't do it, Palestine will be forgotten totally and deleted from the international map.
And this is what they did.
So I've noticed that Israel's most strident defenders, you know, those who are still justifying the ongoing assault on Gaza, tend to argue almost as if the conflict began and ended on October 7th, that this was an unprovoked, unjustified attack on Israel's civilian population, that it was so barbaric. They have no choice but to essentially flatten Gaza. And I guess that's why a film like this is so important, because it addresses that frame of argument head on. This is why the details of what happened on October 7th matter, because what's happening in Gaza today are a direct result of both what happened on that day and what didn't happen, but people think happened that day.
That's right. I mean, to contextualize the events of October the 7th is not to justify them, but clearly you have to understand the background to them. And then the alleged atrocities that happen are then used to justify a response which is massively disproportionate. I mean, the Palestinians are used to disproportionate response, but this is massively disproportionate.
As we record this, at least 32,000 Palestinians in Gaza have been confirmed killed. and the number is likely to be much higher.
The health services have broken down. They can't really count them. Many, many bodies are under the rubble. The war is still ongoing. I mean, by the end of this, it's quite possible that the true figure for dead and injured will not be far off 10% of the population of the Gaza Strip. Hamas did this because they wanted to reinsert the Palestinian people into the political equation of the Middle East. And they succeeded. As they say in our film, they have established the principle that you cannot simply ignore the Palestinian people. But it has come at a colossal cost and the effective destruction of the Gaza Strip. And it's very difficult to see how we move forward from here.
And that's The Take. This episode was produced by Nagin Oliayi and Amy Walters, with Zainab Badr, Sonia Bagat, Farinisa Kampana, David Enders, Sariel Khalili, Chloe K. Lee, Miranda Lin, Ashish Malhotra, Khalid Sultan, and me, Kevin Hurton, in for Malika Bilal. Alex Roldan is our sound designer. Joe Plouard mixed this episode. Alexandra Locke is The Take's executive producer, and Ney Alvarez is Al Jazeera's head of audio. We'll be back.